This is the Leo T. Chrisman Tapes, and this is Tom Sherwood, who is interviewing Dr. Leo T. Chrisman, retired librarian of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. This interview is taking place in room 303 on the 20th of October, 1978. It is a project for the History A611, Oral History, a class I am taking at the University of Louisville. This interview is to be deposited in the archives collection of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Dr. Chrisman, first, for a little background information about yourself. When and where were you born?
I was born in the central part of Missouri, Miller County. It's about 125 miles west of St. Louis. And I was born on the 24th day of February, 1906.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a farmer during most of his life. He spent some of his later years serving as a in the post office at Jefferson City, Missouri, as an employee, and also as a guard at the Missouri State Penitentiary in Jefferson City, Missouri.
What is your educational background?
Well, I started out without very good foundation, it seemed. I never did have any eighth grade work. I had some seventh grade work, but then went to an academy maintained by the Congregational Church in St. Louis, which was located at Iberia, Missouri. My mother had attended that school in the late 1890s. So I was taken in there on a trial basis and completed 1 year of work there. And I was out of school for about 5 years and attended the high school at Eldon, Missouri, and at Jefferson City, Missouri, in 1927. And I was in William Jewell College from fall of 1927 until the summer of 1930, staying there only 3 years and one summer. Then I came to the seminary in September of 1930 and was a student here from September 1930 through April of 1935.
Did you finish college in 3 years?
Not exactly. I did some correspondence work at the University of Kansas after I came here as a student during, say the first two terms of the 1930-31 session seminary.
You are a graduate then of...
Graduate of William Jewell College, that's right, with an A.B. degree.
One of my questions is, what caused you, what was the background that made you interested in coming to Southern Seminary?
Well, I became interested in the ministry after I left Eldon, Missouri, and say during my last year of my high school work at Jefferson City, Missouri. My sister and I were members of the First Baptist Church of Jefferson City, and pastor of the church, Dr. Paul Weber, Sr. He was very much interested in me and directed my interest toward the work of the ministry, so that by the time I went to William Jewell, then I'd pretty well confirmed the fact that I wanted to be a preacher, so to speak. And then after I got there, I learned something about this seminary, and A.T. Robertson came to William Jewell College, I guess in the fall of 1929, I met him. By that time, I had become interested in the language, especially the Greek New Testament, and I decided to come here a year or more before I finished William Jewell College.
Dr. A.T. Robertson was the Greek scholar.
The Greek scholar, professor of New Testament interpretation here at seminary.
how come, or how, what took place that you got into library work?
That was rather accidental as far as I'm concerned. When I graduated from the seminary in April of 1935, I had tried to get located, tried several places. Well, I was primarily interested by that time in teaching, but in those days, in the Depression, every man who had a position teaching in a college held on to it whether he liked to teach or not. So there wasn't much opportunity there, and I had an opportunity to go back to Missouri. Dr. Edgar Godbold was the state secretary at that time, and Dr. Paul Weber was interested in getting me located in Missouri. So I had an opportunity to go to the Glasgow Baptist Church. It's on the Missouri River, about 100 miles east of Kansas City. So I went there in May of 1935 and stayed there for a little more than 2 years. I was looking in correspondence here in the library just today, and I found a letter that Dr. Sampe wrote me dated June 6, 1937, where he invited me to come back to the seminary as a kind of an understudy at the library to work with Dr. Thomas A. Johnson, who had been in the library since 1917. So that took me by surprise, but it was so near the teaching area, which I had been interested for so long, that it didn't take me long to make a decision to come back here. I thought very highly of the seminary, of course, also.
You mentioned a doctor, Godbold.
Dr. Edgar Godbold, G-O-D-B-O-L-D. He was later president of Louisiana College at Pineville, Louisiana.
And you mentioned Paul Weber.
Dr. Paul Weber. He's not a graduate of this seminary. He was born in Switzerland, but grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, and William Jewell College, trained at William Jewell College, and then went to Andover Newton Seminary, came back to Missouri, and was pastor at First Baptist Church, Jefferson City, Missouri, when I was dealt in school, and then when I went on to Jefferson City.
Now his last name is spelled?
W-E-B-E-R, Paul Weber.
And then you mentioned, what were the dates and tenure of your being a librarian at Southern Seminary?
I came here the 1st of August, 1937, and had position, title, Assistant Librarian. I remained in that position from August 1st, 1937 until June the 30th, 1941. And then they stepped me up to Associate Librarian July the 1st, 1941 until April the 19th, 1949. And then on that date, I became acting librarian until March the 13th, 1951. On that date, I became librarian. If you know, recognize the dates, that was after Dr. Fuller's death and while Dr. Gaines S. Dobbins was serving as interim president. And he stepped me up to the position of librarian. And I remained in that position until I retired July 31st, 1971.
And you've mentioned under Dr. Dobbins being made librarian.
Yes.
Who were all the presidents under whom you have worked while at the seminary?
I never knew Dr. Mullins. I had heard of Dr. Mullins, of course, but he died in November of 1928. Before I came here, and I had never had the opportunity to see him or meet him at a convention or any gathering of that sort, so I just never knew him. But as I say, Dr. A.T. Robertson came to the William Jewell College. I met him. I had not met Dr. Sampe and did not know him until I came here. So I served under Dr. Sampi then, 1937 until his death in 1942. Then I served under Dr. Fuller as president from 1942 until October of 1950 when he died. Then under Dr. Dobbins, of course, for about a year, and then under Dr. McCall from 1952 to 1971.
Merely for the record, that those presidents' names were John R. Sampi.
John R. Sampi.
And then
Ellis A. Fuller, and Gaines S. Dobbins, and Dr. Duke K. McCall.
One of the interesting things I noticed in your comments were the fact of being assistant librarian and associate librarian, acting librarian. Were these faculty positions or were they staff positions, or do you know what they were?
It's hard to define them. They're certainly not faculty positions until I became a librarian in 1951, but then I wasn't made a member of the faculty until a few years after Dr. McCall came as president. I was made a faculty member in 1956, in May of 1956. But it was no more than just a staff position during those early years in the library.
Now, I know you gave a faculty address in 1960 in which you gave something of the history of the seminary.
That's right.
For this interview, would you mind reviewing briefly some of that? I've looked through your faculty address briefly, and I'll just mention a few things, and you may want to speak more on others. The seminary opened in 1859 in Greenville, South Carolina. Did it start off with a library or not?
Yes, it started off with a library of about 2,000 volumes, which had come from as theological department of Furman University.
Was that donated to the
seminary? That was donated to the seminary.
When the seminary moved, do you have any idea of the size of the library facility in Greenville? Was there a separate room for it? Was it one side of one room? Or do you have any information on that?
We do not have any exact information about that. The seminary during those years from 1859 to 1877 was located in the building of the First Baptist Church at Greenville, which had been erected in 1826 but had been abandoned by the church congregation in 1857 when they erected a new building. So when the seminary then started in 1859, that building was taken over by the seminary. Dr. Broadus makes reference to it in some of his writings, and then I have had to estimate the building perhaps measured about 28 feet by 40 feet, and Broadus said it was divided by partitions into two lecture rooms and a library. And then he stated that there were 2,000 volumes in the library at the beginning, which had come from the theological portion of the Furman University. And by the time the seminary moved away from there in 1877, the collection had grown to about 7,000 volumes. And that had included a very valuable and historical collection which had come from Columbian University at Washington, D.C. Not a very large volume collection, only about 200 volumes, but a great many of those can still be identified here in this library.
Do you have any information, as you have looked up things in the past, of the actual moving of the library from Greenville to Louisville, Kentucky. In other words, do you have any idea whether it came by, I assume it came by train, or have you ever seen anything on that?
I do not have anything recorded here in regard to it, but seems, or my recollection is, that items that belonged to the seminary were shipped here by train at that time, merely packed in boxes. I believe that I have read that, but I can't locate it at present time.
Was there much study space for the students in the library? Do you have
any? At Greenville? No, I'm only estimating. The student body at that time ranged from about 7 students at the beginning until about 68 when they left there. So they would have had to have seating for only maybe 10 to 12 students to accommodate them in the library. So that was a minor factor in connection with the space allotted to the library there.
When the seminary moved to Louisville in 1877, where was the library located?
Downtown on 4th Street, there was a building called the Public Library Hall, or Polytechnic Building, which later, when I came to Louisville in 1930, was called Kaufman Strauss Building, and then later, Airway placed a store in there for a little while. I do not know how the building is designated at the present time, but the building is still standing on 4th Street, just north of the Starks Building, just 2 or 3 buildings removed from the Starks Building, east side of 4th Street.
The whole seminar, I think, was located in
that building. That's right. The classrooms, the library, and what few offices were necessary were located in that building.
Was there any relationship with the Louisville Free Public Library that you know of?
Yes.
Or was there a Louisville Free Public Library at that time?
Not at that time. It was this Polytechnic Society which maintained the library during all of those years. The Louisville Free Public Library was not organized until about 1902, I believe it was. And at that time, after it was organized, there was, not immediately, but say from long in the 1920s, in the seminary catalogs where reference was made to the library of the seminary, reference was always made to the fact that the library was located close to the Louisville Free Public Library, and that students were welcome to use any materials in Louisville Free Public Library. Those statements remained there until the seminary moved out here in 1926.
The seminary, I know, was located at 5th and Broadway before it moved to the present location. Now, there were several buildings
That's
at
right.
that time.
That's right.
One of those happened to be New York Hall.
Yeah.
Was that the classroom building or the dormitory?
New York Hall was the first one that was erected downtown. It was on the east side of 5th Street, just south of Broadway. And during its early years, then it had to serve for the library. The library was located, I think, on the fourth floor of that building, and then the classrooms were there, and offices were there also, so that until until Norton Hall was erected a little bit later. I'm having difficulty locating these dates right off here, but Norton Hall is described as being on the south side of Broadway between 4th and 5th. See, from the time I remember Louisville, Warren Memorial Presbyterian Church stood at the corner of 4th and Broadway. Well, then there was a little space in there just west of Warren Memorial. Then Norton Hall was placed in there. Then there was a space, a kind of an empty space along the south side of Broadway, a little longer than the width of New York Hall, which ran north and south along the east side of Fifth Street, so that when that second building completed, the Norton Hall, the library was moved. No, the library remained there, and a little later, in 1891, a special library building was erected at the corner of 5th and Broadway, west of 5th Street, south of Broadway. I never did see that building. That had been torn down when I came here. It is where the Bank of Louisville stands at the present time.
In other words, it was across the street from...
Across 5th Street from New York Hall. That is right.
So that was...
That building was erected and dedicated in May of 1891.
So that was the first time the seminary had library had a building of its own.
That's right. That was the first library building.
Do you have any idea of its size?
No, there are pictures of that building, but no architect's drawings can be found anywhere, and no layout of the inside of the building. So I've estimated that the building must have been about extended about 40 feet along the south side of Broadway, and perhaps 30 to 35 feet along the west side of Fifth Street. There were two stories and the basement in addition.
That time, I assume there was much more reading room for the
students. Yes. I'm sure that there was, though, as I say, we do not have any layout of it.
Do you have any idea of the number of volumes that had grown to by that time?
Yes. By the time they came out here, the library collection had grown to about 35,000 volumes. So I suppose that there were somewhere around 20,000 volumes when they moved into that library downtown, and they had grown to about 35,000 volumes when they moved out here.
For the sake of this interview, here, when you say moved out here, you are referring to the campus.
I'm referring to 2825 Lexington Road, or the beaches, as it was often referred to in the earlier accounts.
Do you have any idea of the type of system used for shelving the volumes back in those days in the library? Did they use a duodecimal system?
Yes, we do. When the library was in Greenville, South Carolina, and when it moved from there here, they had only a system whereby they were placed in shelves, and the shelves were designated in numbers, and then the books were numbered by cabinets. I mean, say there were 8 or 10 cabinets, and there were say 5 or 6 shelves on each cabinet. Well, the cabinet had a number, and each shelf had a number. and each book had a number as it stood on the shelf. Now there is a manuscript catalog still in the collection here, which shows how those books were designated on the shelves.
You mentioned cabinets and shelves. This makes me think that there must have been glass encased cabinets rather than open shelving the way we now have them.
Yes.
That
is true, and I think that there are four of those which are still in existence and are still here in this building. I believe that there are in the small rooms at the south end of this third floor of the library. There are cabinets there with adjustable shelves, and they have had glass doors on them in the past, so that and I'm sure that they came out of the library.
I know you've done research in this, but one thing I wonder is, have you found anything in your records of any problems back in those days of students taking books unauthorized from the library, or mutilating books, or anything of that nature?
Yes, Dr. A.T. Johnson, my predecessor, kept rather extensive notes in little notebooks that he had, and there are records going back certainly as early as 1917, when he came to the library, giving a lot of details in regard to how books were missing from time to time, and even naming persons who were involved in such methods of dealings with the books. And I think, if I remember correctly, references are made to that also in the faculty minutes. I had occasion within the past few months to go back over the faculty minutes in the 1910s earlier than that, and I remember a few places where the faculty has had to deal with students who have violated regulations of the library.
You didn't happen to see what kind of penalties might have been attached to some of those?
No, I do not remember that. Now, while I see a record here that I was looking for, you asked me about how they were cataloged or arranged on shelves. The method which I indicated was used in Greenville and during early years here. Dr. Sampe says in his memoirs that in 1890, when he was responsible for the library, that he introduced the duodecimal classification system to the library, and that he, with the help of some of the student assistants, cataloged the books according to the duodecimal classification, and that system has been used up to the present time. We have considered going to other systems a time or two, but we concluded that no system is perfect, no system is complete, and they all have their faults, and we considered this had about as few faults as any others.
You referred to Dr. Johnson, your predecessor. Do you know whether the seminary has had full-time librarians before yourself?
Dr. Thomas A. Johnson was the first full-time librarian. I have checked on the record and have found the names of men who came into the situation as students and then worked part-time, studied part of the time, worked in the library part of the time, long before Dr. Thomas A. Johnson came in 1972, say, under Dr. Sampe. Dr. Sampe was called librarian, but he didn't do the work of the library. He used students. So there was one student by the name of Edgar Allan Forbes from 1897 to 1904. There was a student by the name of John Moncure about 1907, and James Henry Coleman before 1910, and M.N. McFarlane was in here a long time from 1910 until 1916, just before Dr. Thomas A. Johnson came. So a great deal of the work was done by men like that.
If you'll excuse me a moment, yeah. I'm going to turn the tape over.
Okay.
Thank you. Now, you were a librarian from 1937, well, in one capacity or another, until 1971.
That's right.
Did you work by yourself, or did you have assistants?
As I indicated, Dr. Thomas A. Johnson was still living here when I came on the 1st of August, 1937. I worked with him until his death on November the 9th, 1939, a little more than 2 years. And then I was on my own. From that time on, as far as directing the work of the library.
The seminary moved to the present campus in those days called the Beaches, at the present located at 2825 Lexington Road. When the seminary moved here, where was the library located?
When the library came out here in 1926, when the seminary came out here, a specially constructed library facilities had been erected at the extreme west end of Norton Hall. The area which is called Broadus Hall at the present time, and then the arena type of auditorium there with the post office and the bookstore beneath it. That was a stack area. There were three levels of stacks in that area. And then the offices were in the area between the long Broadus Hall and the area which is the arena at the present time.
Did students have access to the stack area?
It was a closed stack operation when I came here, and it was erected with that in view. We opened up the stacks before we moved out of that building in 1959.
Now you referred to move out of that building, Norton Hall, in 1959. What happened in 1959?
In November, this building, which is called the James P. Boyce Centennial Library, had been erected, and we moved then over here at that time.
Why is it called Boyce Centennial Library?
As you indicated a while ago, the seminaries organized in 1859 a drive to collect funds for the building of a new library was begun in the middle 1950s, and planning was done in the later 1950s. The building construction was begun in 1958 and then completed in 59. So that made it a centennial project, and they named it for James P. Boyce. That gave us a little added publicity and incentive in the fund drive for completing the building.
I noticed in your inaugural address, introductory remarks, you referred to many libraries are named after donors, yes. their libra- individuals' libraries. And I was wondering if that was in your relationship with the Boyce Centennial Library, but apparently that's not.
Of course, Boyce gave a lot of books to the library. He had built up a personal library to the extent of about 10,000 volumes when he died late in 1888. That collection was divided in two, the more secular books in one group and the theological books in the other. So 5,000 volumes of his books came into the seminary library. Of course, that was while it was still in New York Hall downtown. That was one of the incentives, of course, in naming it for Boyce, and then also the fact that he had been the first president of the seminary.
Who approved the plans, or who designed the plans for the present library building?
In 1950, before the death of Dr. Fuller, some of us, members of the faculty, and with myself, had visited other libraries, looking toward, a building, a separate library building. But at the death of Dr. Fuller, of course, planning stage stopped. Then about 1957, Dr. McCall became interested in the planning, and we visited several libraries. We went to Atlanta, Georgia, and looked at Georgia Tech Library. We were at Albany, Georgia, and looked at the University of Georgia Library. And then we were also at Florida State University, Tallahassee. That was a library building that impressed us more than any of the others. We'd also seen others, and members of the faculty, of course, who were involved and knew of others. So we were so interested in that we had a man by the name of Kilpatrick, I believe was his name, who was librarian at present time, to come up here and to help us in designing a library. Of course, this is not nearly so large a library as that is. I was very much interested to hear this past summer when Andy Rawls had been studying at Florida State University in his work and audiovisuals and so forth. And when he came back here, he said to me, "Said I get the impression that this library is very much like the Florida State University Library." I told him he is right, that served as a pattern for the planning of this library, and that the librarian there helped us in the planning.
Do you know if the plans of the library as they were executed and built, as the library was built, provides for expansion either up or backwards to the back or any direction?
Yes, there were very definite provisions made for that. As I indicated, we were planning, patterning after the pattern of Florida State University, much bigger than this. So we saw something of the possibilities for a much larger library with practically the same number of stairwells, the elevators in the same location and so forth. So we made provision so that we could build onto the back of this building 40 feet out. That would be two modules wide. See, these modules are 25 feet long, 20 feet wide, so that we could go back 40 feet. All of the utility serving the building were installed back beyond that 40-foot limit, so it's the only parking area there. All that would have to be destroyed would be parking area. None of the utilities would have to be moved, so that by building proper foundations, four levels could be placed back there, 175 feet long, 40 feet wide, which would be a tremendous increase over the space in this library.
You think the library has proved adequate, or at least relatively adequate, since it's been built?
Yes, I think so. The greater problem has been the other, say, areas of the seminary work which have been planned and placed into the library. Dean's Lecture Hall, of course, was planned in there. It could hardly be changed. The museum has come in and has been pressing for more and more space all along. The music library came in, of course, in the planning, but late. So that has been planned all along. There have been a few things that have come in that way which have taken up space. We've had to be very careful and be very diligent to see if those things don't get out of hand. But generally, the library areas and facilities have served the purpose for which they have been planned. And may I make one further statement also in regard to the building. The buildings here on the seminary campus at present time are just a little more than 50 years old. I had in mind when I was planning this library, and I do not want to take away from Dr. McCall his interest in the building and the fact that perhaps as many of his ideas went into the building as there were mine. But my idea was that this building was planned to be used for 100 years, and after we've been in it here now for almost 30 years, I see no deterioration in anywhere that would indicate that the building's not going to last for a century or longer.
Do you recall? Of course, I could ask you how many volumes were in the library when you moved from downtown to the Oakland campus, or how many, and how it increased from then until the time it moved to its present building. You might want to just mention that.
Yeah, there were 35,000 volumes that were moved from downtown out here to the west end of
Norton Hall.
And then when we got ready to move out of the Norton Hall area over here, I cannot see that figure before me right at the present time. But by that time, we'd gotten into a kind of a contest, a kind of a conflict as to how you number and what you number with individual numbers and so forth, so that Southwestern Seminary was claiming a library of way over 150,000 volumes and so forth. And then in competition with them, we were padding our figures to some extent, so it's hard to determine that. But I would say, in the area, a good solid count of bound volumes of books and periodicals, we were somewhere in the general neighborhood of 100,000 volumes. Now, that wouldn't be counting individual minutes of district associations or individual scores of music numbers and things like that, which could be used to run the count up to 200,000 volumes or something like that.
You indicated a contest type of counting of volumes with Southwestern. Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary is located in Fort Worth, Texas. It's one of the other Southern Baptist seminaries. I mentioned this for the sake of the interview. I gather there must be among librarians some question as to how you count volumes.
That is true. Librarians in their organizations have tried to set out standards for what is a volume, what is a pamphlet, and so forth. But Southwestern Seminary got their count way beyond any reasonable number. For instance, there for a while, they were publishing as their total number of volumes a figure that far exceeded the total number of volumes in Union Theological Seminary Library in New York City. Well, in the 1950s and 1960s, everybody knew that Union Theological Seminary had to have a far better library than Southwestern Seminary had, but they were claiming that, and one time claiming to be the largest theological seminary library in the world. They may be still claiming that. I don't know.
Do you recall the actual mechanics involved in moving the library volumes from Norton Hall to the present Washingtonian Library? How was it done?
Yeah. So we considered several different methods. For instance, putting them all in the large boxes and hauling them over by trucks to the back door, basement door, and bring them up on the elevator. Then at one time we considered a kind of a conveyor belt from the north end of the stacked area over at the Norton Hall Library in to the second floor here in this library. But we finally decided that by packing periodicals and things of that nature, that these other methods would take so long that the students would be deprived of the use, of the basic books of the library over too long a period of time. So we decided then that we would use the students, as many of them as would volunteer, and that we would start with the zeros and then go to the 100s and the 200s and the decimal classifications, taking them out of the old library building, carry them over here into the main door and onto the main floor, and then some of us who were acquainted with the library and materials would direct to where they would be placed on the shelves. So that deprived the students of the use of the books for a very brief period. I believe that it was all done in about 2 days. Maybe it didn't take all of 2 days to get them over here.
So students brought them from the Norton Hall Library facility that, over
right.
to this one and
that's
went
right.
directly from one shelf to the other shelf.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Changing the subject somewhat. Can you tell us something about the financial backing or funding of the library, as you recall it?
You mean the building, the erection of the building?
I'm talking about the general operation
yes.
of the library. In other words, the building of this building, you said, was by solicitation.
That's right. That's right.
I'm thinking about the year in and year out
yeah.
of funding. Is it But in the regular budget, or is it, why is it?
That is true. I have some interesting notes here about the early years of the seminary when not very much money was expended for the library. I read here just a brief note from James P. Boyce in June of 1884 to Dr. Broadus. Boyce was in New York raising money, and he wrote to Dr. Broadus, "I intended to warn you lest you should purchase any books for the library this summer. I am anxious to cut down seminary expenses." So there seems to have been at least one very extensive period when no funds whatever were expended for the library. Yes, there was was a budget. I really didn't have anything to do with that for even long after the death of Dr. Thomas A. Johnson. I indicated, or I don't know whether I did or not, that Dr. W. Hersey Davis called himself librarian of the seminary. That was a reason that I was called assistant librarian up until 41 and associate librarian until 49 and acting librarian until 51, because Davis held on to that position as a librarian of the seminary. Well, he also controlled,
Dr. Davis, Hersey Davis?
Dr. W. Hersey Davis, that is right.
And he was a faculty member.
He was a faculty member.
Held the title of librarian.
Held the title of librarian. He then got involved with the making of the budget, and I really didn't have anything to do with the budget until, well, certainly way up into the 1940s. I don't remember definitely that I did under Dr. Fuller's administration or not. I guess I did later, we operated on the budget there for many, many years, only about $2,500 a year for the purchase of materials.
I can recall some years back when there was an emphasis on allowing more of the budget to go towards the library facilities and purchase of books and et cetera.
Yeah, that was when we got in trouble with the accrediting agency of the American Association of Theological Schools, and we were spending a lot of money there for books and the periodicals in order to erase a notation which the accrediting agency had placed against us.
What kind of notation was it?
Well, all the information I ever got in regard to it was that we had an inadequate library. That never satisfied me, because I was persuaded all that time if they'd gone to Southwestern Seminary and had examined that collection, they could have said of that library that it was an inadequate library. So there are reasons that I better not get involved in right here, in which I would use to explain that.
Has there always been a library? Well, we've referred to librarians being faculty members. I'm assuming, therefore, that part of the time the librarian's job was a part-time job rather than a full-time job.
But see, even if Thomas A. Johnson came in as full-time librarian in 1917, he was called assistant librarian for. No, Dr. Thomas A. Johnson came in 1916. He was called assistant librarian until 1929. That was after Mullins had died, after Sampey had become president. And then Davis had been brought in the relationship of that Sampi had retained so long in relation to the library. So then a little later, in 1929, about that time, Dr. Johnson was called librarian, and for 10 years he was called a librarian. At that time, Dr. Davis was called chief librarian.
To whom did the librarian, Dr. Johnson, for instance, and yourself, report to in the organization-type structure? Was it to the president, or was it to a faculty member?
No, it was always Dr. W.H. Davis. He was over Dr. Johnson. Dr. Johnson reported to him. Then when Sampi came in as president, and after Dr. Johnson died, Dr. Sampi began to edge Dr. Davis out, and he dealt, with Dr. Johnson directly a lot, and then he dealt with me directly a lot, and Dr. Davis didn't like that arrangement too well.
In other words, was that sometimes a problem?
Yes, it was a problem. That is true. Really, I never got along very well with Dr. Davis. I was a student under him from 1930 to 1935. Then when I entered in the doctoral program under Dr. A.T. Robertson died before I finished my work, and I finished under Dr. Davis, and I didn't like too well the way Davis had dealt with me. And so relationships were very unpleasant, especially after Dr. Fuller came in 1942.
After Dr. Fuller came in 1942, structurally, to whom did the library, yourself,
I still reported to Dr. Davis, except when Fuller would step in bypass Davis and deal directly with me. Not too happy a situation even there.
Well, now, Dr. Fuller died in
1950, September 1950.
But Dr. Davis had left year before 1950.
Yeah, Dr. Davis left, I believe, in 49, about a year before that. So he'd had to give up. My notes here indicate that in 1949 I was made acting librarian. Well, Fuller wasn't willing to go all the way and call me librarian. Dr. Davis wasn't on the scene, you see, but still, I didn't get to be co-librarian until Dr. Dobbins came in 1951 as acting president, as after the death of Dr. Fuller.
And then you reported to Dr. Dobbins as acting president.
Yes, there was a library committee, but it was advisory. Some of the committees later on were not too much advisory. They stepped in and assumed an authoritarian role, but I reported directly to Dr. Dobbins.
Excuse me, I don't think so.